one of Freud's letters to Ferenczi. It is a letter dated October 1918, just before the truce that ended World War I. And in this letter, Freud was responding to Ferenczi's lament over the demise and disintegration of the monarchy. And his advice to Ferenczi reads like that, I quote, "Withdraw your libido from your fatherland in a timely fashion and shelter it in psychoanalysis, or else you will have to feel uncomfortable."
Welcome to the IPA podcast. For those of you who have been listeners to the past 40 episodes of this podcast series, you know that we've been focusing on analysts who bring their clinical skills to venues outside of the consulting room, hence the name psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Given that we are all facing together a crisis of unfathomable proportions, we're going to be changing the focus of our podcast. We are going to be interviewing psychoanalysts from all corners of the globe to discuss with them how their local communities are coping with this situation, how their clinical work has been affected by this situation, and also how the internal worlds of both the analyst and the patient have been impacted by this virus, as it impacts both our real fears and our imaginary fears. We're going to encounter not only uncertainty and fear, but we're also going to learn great wisdom, gifted empathy, and hope. We'll be maintaining the title of this podcast, both as a testament to our past work and as a placeholder for our future work. I hope you find these conversations both informative and sustaining. Feel free to write comments on our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Thank you.
Welcome, everyone, to today's podcast. I'm Dr. Stephen Rolfe. I'm an analyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia and chair of the American Psychoanalytic Association's Committee on Corporate and Organizational Consulting. I'm managing principal of Rolfe Advisory and specialize in psychodynamic leadership advisory services for CEOs and boards, family enterprises, and leaders facing a personal life crisis. I'm delighted today to welcome Dr. Aaron Rolnick to today's podcast. Dr. Rolnick is a training and supervising analyst at the Israel Psychoanalytic Society. He's a psychiatrist and historian and on the faculty of Tel Aviv University, faculty of the Humanities and Tel Aviv University School of Postgraduate Training in Psychotherapy at the Faculty of Medicine. He is on the faculty of the Max Eitingon Institute for Psychoanalysis. He's authored, edited, co-edited, and translated more than 20 books and over 70 peer-reviewed journal papers. He recently translated from German and edited a volume with Freud's letters. This volume lasted for several months in Israel's bestsellers list for nonfiction. Aaron, welcome to the podcast. I really appreciate your being here with us at this time of great anticipation and peril in both the United States and Israel. Perhaps we could begin by hearing about the state of the pandemic in Israel, as we've been hearing much about it recently. And we want to speak today about practice, the nature of practice, of therapy and analysis, and how the experience of treating patients is being affected by our current world situation.
Thank you. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you for inviting me for this podcast. I think that our talk will evolve around, politics and psychoanalysis. because we are living in times where it is difficult and also, I believe, unnecessary to distinguish between what is going on in world affairs and what is going on in people's mind, that is, in our offices. And you asked me about the state of the pandemic here in Israel. It's hard to tell, you know. Technically, I think it is getting better during the past because we are just nearing the end of our second lockdown. And this lockdown, I think, strained the patience of the population to its limits. No doubt, it will be very difficult to force a third one. Benjamin Netanyahu has exhausted the patience of both his opponents and his fans, I think, to a degree that as of today, in 5 hours' time, I think, the second lockdown is to end. And come what may, tomorrow morning, Sunday, being Israel, the first workday of the week, millions of Israeli will return gradually, though, to the work. Shops will gradually be opened, not immediately. One could still go to the beach beginning tomorrow morning, which we're all looking forward to do again. This is the best time of year to be at the beach in Tel Aviv right now. And the numbers of critically ill patients is not staggering. And, you know, it's hard to tell how far did we get towards the limits, the limit of the hospital's capacity here. Because, you know, Israel is pretty well equipped to handle a large amount of casualties by nature of its being Israel. So when we speak about COVID right now in Tel Aviv, we are not so much worried about health issues. We are more worried about the future of our democracy, which has been severely eroded over the past 6 months. Israeli government was shaken too many times. The current coalition is unreliable, if not entirely perverted, by different interests and agendas. So what we have to deal with is right now a political situation where a prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is holding tenaciously to his seat, even though he is facing very severe charges, the kind of which no prime minister in Israel was never charged with. And here we are in these circumstances trying to treat patients. And as I told you earlier, I don't think that our patients are very concerned with their health, if they are worried about their the health of their democracy. And this gives one ample opportunities to worry nowadays. But, you know, being historically trained clinician, I sometimes try to console myself by, looking back into the near or the distant past of my discipline. And it does offer some consolation, you know. Psychoanalysis has survived very dark eras.
Please console us.
No, I will be able to console us only after I raise your anxiety a little bit. You know, I recently published a collection of Freud's letters. It's an assembly of annotated letters by Freud written to 70 different recipients. And one of these letters I choose to include in these in this volume was one of Freud's letters to Ferenczi. It is a letter dated October 1918, just before the truce that ended World War I. And in this letter, Freud was responding to Ferenczi's lament over the demise and disintegration of the monarchy. And his advice to Ferenczi reads like that, I quote, "Withdraw your libido from your fatherland in a timely fashion and shelter it in psychoanalysis, or else you will have to feel uncomfortable," end of quote. Freud's recommendation that Ferenczi shelter, so to speak, his libido in psychoanalysis marked the emergence of a tradition in which analytic identity was expected to encourage the disintegration of ethnic, national, or even political bonds. In fact, 4 years earlier, at the height of the First World War, Ernst Jones wrote to Freud, I quote again, that if the future of psychoanalysis had to be weighed with the future of my own country, that is Great Britain, I should side with the former, end of quote. I think such statements should not be read as gestures of loyalty to Freud, or at least not just as gestures of loyalty and partisanship. Because in the early 20th century, psychoanalysis was viewed not only by Freud, but by many of his students as an antidote to the discontents of modern political subject. And as you know, in my book, Freud in Zion, and in fact, the talk I gave not so long ago to your society in Philadelphia, I pointed out that I'm very much interested from both the historical and clinical perspective in identifying theoretical preferences and modes of thought within psychoanalysis that reflect political and cultural identifications. Now, that is to say, however hard we try to disengage or to remain neutral on matters political or cultural, I think that our writing, at least, and our clinical thinking harbors a great deal of political identifications and I would say splits and part identifications. And I think that the historiography of psychoanalysis, if you follow the development of psychoanalytic ideas, you see many, many examples to the relationship between sociopolitical and cultural sentiments and the emergence of particular analytical subcultures. I'll just give a few examples. Most of them are well known. I think the interest in Freud's Jewish identity, which came to the fore in different aspects and moments in the history of psychoanalysis, not least during the Nazi era, or the influence of communism on interpretation to the Oedipus complex in Soviet Russia, or indeed the influence of pragmatism on ego psychology in post-World War II America, or the part played by anti-Americanism in the development of French and in particular Lacanian psychoanalysis. I think that quite often such extra-analytic identifications constitute the hidden passengers in the analyst's identification cargo. What I mean by that is that hidden aspect which facilitates or limits the analyst's clinical sensibilities. I think that we often fail to take notice of the impact of these identifications on our personal analytic thinking or on the functioning of our institutions at the group level. It is only under extreme circumstances, and I believe we are heading towards such an extreme
circumstance. If I could interrupt for a second, Aaron, and go back to your original quote. The original quote that you gave was it Fenichel?
With Ferenczi.
I was actually thinking of another one of your quotes that you talked about in the Freud and Zion book in 1933, which was Fenichel, right? Where I think you quote him as being asked by another analyst in 1933 about where things stand in terms of psychoanalytic research. What was he interested in? Yeah. And you quote him as saying, "Well, I'm particularly interested in whether and when the Nazis will seize power in Vienna."
Yes.
I relate that to your earlier quote and to the things that you're talking about only because how are you reading that earlier quote? The earlier quote has to do with that the focus should be in some way on analysis, withdrawing the libido from the world into analysis in some way, right?
I think the quote, the letter to Ferenczi from the end of the First World War would correspond, I think, to where we are now, where most of us are not, critically threatened politically. We are not yet at a time where, as Fenichel was in 33, where you can no longer hold your private practice, or you have to worry that your patient will turn out to be a regime informant. We are now at a point where we are holding the crisis as it is still in our mind. We are sitting in our chairs, pretty anxious on various levels, right? We are dealing with a patient who may literally infect us with COVID if he's, attending his daily session as usual. And this might be an elephant in the room, as it is. If you are worried that your patient just came back from the supermarket and he's in fact quite complacent about it. He's telling you happily that he entertained guests the other night, and you find yourself worrying and not so much listening to free association.
So, Aaron, let me just interrupt for a second. I understand then you're actually treating patients in the office, because most of us in the States are not. We're conducting all the treatment by Zoom. Were you not doing that in Israel, or?
I've divided my patients into those whom I continue seeing in the office, on the couch, as usual, and those which I would rather treat with a video talk, yes, with Zoom. How did I make the distinction between those who can still come and see me in my office? Well, I have my, parameters, and those who are, not coming into contact with other people by nature of their work or daily habits are invited to come and see me personally. This is a fairly spacious room. I open the windows. I make sure everything is disinfected, including the couch, And so far, I've been able to treat my analytic patients as before. It is so that the younger patients, those who hang around in you know busy places and go to you know to the markets and to the beach, it is to those patients to whom I suggested that we switch to Zoom therapy.
I see. Okay.
But it is considered, you know, an essential capacity, and you know, being a psychiatrist, my patients can even under lockdown conditions, they are allowed to walk to me or even come by car.
I see. Understood. So you were talking a moment ago about the patient's fantasies and about.
Let me give an example. You know, I think it is. You know, it is always useful, you know, as an analyst to be reminded of the fact that the patient is someone else. You know, it's common knowledge among analysts. You know, I think the idea of otherness is crucial to analytic thinking and therapy, but at times like ours, when we and the patient are no doubt in the same boat from the point of view of history and common sense, I think it is all the more challenging to perceive and interpret the unique unconscious meaning the patient is giving to his experience of this pandemic. A few days ago, just give an example, you know, of these, you know, which is our daily bread, I think, to most of us right now. A patient is saying something along the lines of, "You are not the right analyst for me right now." You know what she says? "I wish you were older. I wish you were my age, that is more concerned with death, as I am right now. Only then you could understand what it means to be alone in your home all day, thinking about the future of your children and being unable to see your grandchildren, being unable to take part in social and professional life, as," she goes on, "I used to do before I retired." Now, the patient's words, as was her wont, she said it in a reproaching tone, made sense to me, and I began to think about my shortcomings as an analyst in terms of the 20 years or so that separate, so to speak, me from her chronologically. But then it dawned on me that perhaps I'm rushing into, you know, adapting her identification, because at the very beginning of this analysis, the patient fantasized that my biography makes me particularly well suited to understand her because of a particular detail in my biography she knew in advance. And later on in analysis, she complained that as a male analyst, I will never be able to understand her, etc., in the same way that her previous three lady analysts she had did. What I mean to say is that I had to remind myself of this fact, that at any given moment in this analysis, there existed a fantasy translated into a complaint, a projection, that I need to be someone else in order to be able to be her analyst. Now, with such a patient sharing a common anxiety, the anxiety of the pandemic, may prove, I think, to be a hindrance rather than an advantage, if I really want to explore issues of otherness and, you know, terms of endearment analytically. But, you know, as I'm talking to you now, Steve, I'm being quite offensive. That is, it is perhaps I'm being, in this case, all too analytical in my handling of the situation with my patient. Should I not instead ask myself plainly, can psychoanalysis and its patients endure this current crisis? And this, you know, brings me back to the question I faced in my previous, you know, research and work. Is there a point where you can no longer practice psychoanalysis? Is there a point where exploring the mind, the unconscious ramifications of the mind, is no longer tenable? Are we approaching a point, either politically, because we are not only dealing here with a pandemic, but also with an impending threat to democracy? I am not in a position to assess the danger in America right now, but it seems to me that Israel is not the only country in the world right now where the idea of free speech and free thinking is no longer self-evident. And it goes hand in hand with the pandemic. A Trump-like leader could easily make our profession an impossible profession. And not in the sense, in the Freudian sense, but in a political sense. In the financial sense you quoted earlier, in the sense that we can no longer explore the mind because the idea of a private sphere is being challenged or downright attacked by culture and politics.
You said you would raise my anxiety, and I think you have, because I'm also recalling the example that you gave in 1932 when Eitingen was congratulated for all he had done for the city of Leipzig, and how quickly things changed overnight.
And you know, I remind you that when Eitingen told Freud that he intends to leave Berlin and emigrate to Jerusalem of all places, Freud was angry. He did not think that the situation warrants such a decision. Nor did he was in agreement with the choice of country. But leaving this aspect aside, I think that at various points in the history of psychoanalysis, there comes a dispute amongst analysts. Is it time to stop seeing patients? The circumstances may change. In our time, this is a health issue. In other times, it was a political issue. Is the patient endangering me in some way? Is the patient, by being a political activist, endangering the analyst or other patients seen by this same analyst? We are sometimes underestimating the fragility of our profession. We are not just medical doctors. Most of us are no longer medical doctors, technically, I mean, officially. But this is a unique practice. We should not take it for granted, not even in the American democracy. And I think that as time goes by, we will see the impact of technology in our crisis. I, for once, don't think that by switching to Zoom with a patient, we are just being, you know, technically diligent. No, we have introduced something entirely new into the analysis. This cannot be reversed. Zoom therapy, however well justified under these circumstances, is from the point of view of analytic philosophy and theory, a very, very problematic way of interaction with patients. This dissolution of the body and the word, that the patient is not present in the room, is something we should not be taking lightly, I think.
I certainly agree. You know, I just want to return to one thing you said when you were talking about the fragility of our work, the fragility of our treatment, because it seemed to me that that fragility, that really echoed, that really captured what your patient was really trying to say to you and wondering whether you really could appreciate the fragility under which she was
living. That's a very good point, Steve. I think a very sensitive point, I think. She actually scolded me for being perhaps healthier, no doubt younger. She doesn't know if I'm really healthier than she is. Doesn't know me that well. But she assumes that if I see her during the pandemic, I feel safe enough physically. On the other end, it was her choice to keep seeing me. She was given a choice to take a break. And she chose to walk a very short distance from her home and see me every day as she's used to. I think that by fragility, she may have perceived me, she still does, as someone who has something to lean on. Psychoanalysis is not just a profession, you know, it's a confession. And we are being perceived sometimes as, you know, as professionals who are zealous and very loyal to a particular Weltanschauung or point of view, which some of our patients may envy and some may think to be ludicrous. So fragility may mean for her that I am being not complacent in terms of my health, but perhaps I'm willing to sacrifice something for the sake of psychoanalysis. Mm-hmm. Perhaps I'm willing to sacrifice more than she would like to sacrifice herself. Because being an analyst, sitting with patients 8-10 hours a day, isolated from the hums and buzzes of external reality, this could be perceived as a privilege and as a worrisome attitude towards life. And right now, reality is very tempting. Tempting, I mean, in a sense that you can throw yourself on the real and neglect the symbolic, and you will not be considered concrete or rude by doing that. It is perfectly normal to stay home and watch TV all day.
Right. If I could just pick up on something you said previously and turn our attention in the time we have left to your comments, your thoughts about Freud and about how Freud handled, and this is obviously a very big topic, but if we could just, if you could just introduce it a bit and talk about, you know, the implications of how Freud handled the times of extreme anxiety, the world he was living in, and the fact that he didn't leave, and how it, until it was almost too late, and how it affected the theory, and how it affected our theory. I think it's only recently that we're people like you and others have really, you know, focused on how much of our theory was affected by the extraordinary circumstances under which it was developed, and so much of that seemed to be denied.
First of all, we have to remind that it was during times of crisis that theory made its greatest development in Freud's mind. It has several explanations, the one being a technical one. When Freud was not seeing patients, he had more time to sit and write and publish. And I think we can expect an outflow of papers and books as a result of the recent world events, I think. Analysts, busy analysts, write more when they don't see patients. And Freud definitely used this time, and we have evidence of his preference for, writing than over seeing patients. Freud was not a happy clinician. He was a happy writer and theoretician. He made no secret of it that he treated more patients than he actually wanted to in order to make ends meet. On the other hand, there are, of course, moments in psychoanalytic theory, such as during the Great War, the First World War, where Freud is responding to the zeitgeist, to his private concerns and worries about sons in the front. And we have various papers by Freud, beautiful papers written during the war, which echo a concern with death, with transience, with the loss of the good object, with the faith of love under extreme circumstances. So we have to thank, I think, some of the biggest advances in psychoanalytic theory to times of war and times of trouble, either personally or globally in Freud's lifetime. As to his own reaction, I would say reluctance to read the writing on the wall in 1933, I think it is not fair to say, as some scholars do tend to say, that Freud was oblivious, that he showed an attitude of denial to the rise of Nazism. I don't think that he denied the dangers of Nazism, but he had rather a sense of urgency in his quest to accomplish as many milestones theoretically during these years. This is how I tend now to explain Freud's insistence to stay in Vienna to the very last minute, his disappointment with students who left Vienna or left Berlin and left the institute there to the non-Jewish analysts, whom Freud considered not as brilliant as the leaders of the Berlin Institute and the Vienna Institute. So I think Freud, the aging Freud, is concerned with the survival of psychoanalysis rather than with the survival of himself and also his dear ones, yes. And this is why he postponed any attempt to flight.
I see. Well, Aaron, I think we're going to have to stop there. I really want to thank you so much for such a rich conversation. I can't, though, stop this interview without recommending to the audience one of your previous books. I haven't read your most recent books. I look forward to that very eagerly. But I really want to recommend to our audience the book Freud and Zion, Psychoanalysis and the Making of Modern Jewish Identity. I think it's just, it's one of my favorite books, really. I think it's just a terrific history of analysis and a history of Israel and Zionism and the complexity of the development of theory all throughout that period of history. And I can't recommend it enough. And I really want to thank you again for participating in this podcast. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Stephen. It has been a pleasure. And I'm hopeful that out of this crisis, new and interesting psychoanalytic ideas will arise.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.